My audiobooks.ai presents The Question the Jury Was Asked, inside the first Lindsay Clancy trial.
On the morning of August 27th, 2026, in a Plymouth courtroom, Judge William Sullivan looked at 12 jurors and read them the sentence that an entire five-week trial had been built around. The Commonwealth, he told them, must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Lindsay Clancy committed the crime with which she is charged. And then he added the clause that separates an American murder trial from a simple accounting of facts, and also that the defendant is criminally responsible for her conduct. Two burdens, not one. The government had to prove what happened, and it had to prove something no camera, no document, and no witness could directly show. What Lindsay Clancy's mind was capable of in the minutes when her three children died.
This is the first of two articles about what happened next, about the legal question the jury was actually asked to decide, and about the procedural crisis that meant they never got to answer it. The second article covers the 8 days of deadlock that ended the trial. This one is about the question itself, because the question is stranger and harder than the public conversation about this case has ever admitted. It was not, did she do it? The defense conceded the acts from the opening statement. It was not, is she mentally ill? The prosecution's own experts conceded that too, on the record. The question the jury took into the deliberation room was whether the Commonwealth had proved, beyond a reasonable doubt, that a woman with a mental disease nonetheless retained enough of two specific capacities that the law could hold her responsible for what that disease did. And the uncomfortable truth this article will develop is that the legal test the jury was given asks a question that no method on earth exists to answer reliably, and that the trial became a contest over who could sound more certain, providing the uncertainty.
A note on sources before anything else, because it matters for how the quotations in this article should be read. Everything quoted here comes from public recording-derived transcriptions of the trial, 22 sessions of them, from the July 29th openings through the August 27th charge, and from public recordings of the post-trial hearings. They are not certified court reporter transcripts. Certified copies, for the record, would run into five figures for a case this size, and are ordered through the Massachusetts Office of Transcription Services. The quotes here were checked against the recording-derived text and carry the timestamps of those recordings. Where a speaker label in a public transcript could be wrong, this article says so, rather than silently treating it as fact.
The legal test at the center of the trial comes from a Massachusetts case called Commonwealth versus McCool, and Judge Sullivan read it to the jury in pieces, and every piece matters. A person is not criminally responsible, he instructed, if she has a mental disease or defect, and as a result lacks the substantial capacity either to appreciate the criminality or wrongfulness of her conduct, or to conform her conduct to the requirements of the law. Unpack that slowly, because the jury had to. The test has two arms. A thinking arm, could she appreciate what her conduct was in the fullest sense? And a control arm, could she have obeyed the law, even if she understood it? Fail either arm because of a mental disease or defect, and the law says the person cannot be held criminally responsible at all.
At myaudiobooks.ai, you can create your own audiobooks from prompts, turn your documents into audio, all with one subscription, and store your items in your own personal library.
Now, the subtleties that the entire 5 weeks turned on. Mental disease or defect, the judge told the jury, is a legal term, not a medical one. It need not fit any formal diagnosis in any psychiatric manual. That sentence quietly detaches the verdict from the entire clinical record. The jury was not being asked to vote on a diagnosis. And then, the most important single word in the charge, appreciate. The judge defined it precisely, to understand, rather than merely to know. It is not enough, he said, For the Commonwealth to show that the defendant merely knew or was intellectually aware that her conduct was illegal or wrong. The government must prove that a mental disease did not deprive her of a meaningful understanding of the legal or moral significance of what she was doing. Knowing is a switch.
Appreciating, in the law's sense, is a depth. And no instrument ever built can measure the depth of another person's understanding in a moment that has already passed.
The burden structure gave the prosecution a curious kind of option. To win, the Commonwealth did not have to prove Lindsay Clancy was well. It had to prove at least one of two things beyond a reasonable doubt. Either that she had no mental disease or defect at all, or that if she did have one, she nonetheless retained the substantial capacity to appreciate the wrongfulness of her conduct and to conform her conduct to the law. The second path is the one that turned the trial into what it became, because it meant the prosecution could concede the illness, could even prove the illness, and still win, as long as it could show the illness left the two capacities intact.
Which is how a murder trial ended up with both sides arguing, from the same set of facts, that the evidence proved their answer to a question of philosophy.
Here is the undisputed baseline, stated with the restraint this article maintains throughout. On January 24, 2023, in Duxbury, Massachusetts, Lindsay Clancy's three children, ages 5, 3, and 8 months, were killed in the family home, and she then attempted to take her own life, an attempt that left her permanently paralyzed. The defense did not contest the acts. The prosecution did not contest that she had been in psychiatric treatment for months. Everything else, every witness, every exhibit, every expert, was about the space between those two facts.
The prosecution's model, laid out in the opening by Assistant District Attorney Sprague, was planning and window. This was not a woman in the throes of psychosis, she told the jury. This was a woman who acted intentionally, rationally, and swiftly to accomplish a very specific goal. The centerpiece of the model was the window of time. The defendant, the Commonwealth argued, drew her husband out of the house that evening so that she had the opportunity and the time to carry out the killings. And then, when he called mid-act from the pharmacy, she answered, spoke normally for 14 seconds, and continued. A woman who can manage a phone call mid-sequence, the model says, is a woman steering.
The voice she later described, a male voice never heard before or since, telling her it was her last chance. The prosecution invited the jury to examine by source, timing, and substance. No direction, no details, and an immediate, flawlessly executed response.
The defense's model, laid out by Attorney Reddington, was command and collapse. A woman driven by postpartum illness and a medication cascade into a psychosis in which a command hallucination, a voice experienced as issuing orders the hearer feels unable to disobey, left no choice at all, followed by a suicide attempt so violent it shattered her spine. The documentary spine of this model is the treatment chronology, and it is worth walking slowly, because the defense walked it slowly for the jury. September 2022, a new mother of three, unable to sleep more than 2 or 3 hours a night, seeks help and is prescribed sertraline, Zoloft, which Reddington told the jury you do not give to a bipolar person. The adverse reaction leaves her unable to feel anything at all.
November. An emergency room visit for depression and exhaustion, referral to a perinatal behavioral health program, and the beginning of a rotation through providers and prescriptions. Lorazepam, hydroxyzine, buspirone, trazodone, fluoxetine. Early December, she calls a suicide hotline. A crisis team evaluation follows. Mid-December, her parents move in from Connecticut because she is, in her husband's description, rocking on the sofa, crying, unable to function. Late December, a partial hospitalization program in Rhode Island, an emergency room at Mass General, and then on New Year's Eve, admission to McLean Hospital, the psychiatric hospital, where she stays into the new year. January. Discharge, follow-up appointments, more medication changes, and an appointment with her psychiatrist the day before the killings. And one more entry in the chronology, the one the defense said the case turned on. In December, she told her husband, in her mother's presence, that she was having psychotic thoughts of hurting the children.
At myaudiobooks.ai, you can listen to this story and thousands of others that explore the hidden science and mechanics behind the headlines. Both models are, on their face, coherent readings of the same timeline. That is precisely the problem, and it is why the trial came down to three expert witnesses whose opinions split in a way that should teach anyone how this kind of evidence actually works.
For the defense, Dr. Philip Resnick, a forensic psychiatrist whose name carries weight in this field nationally, gave the cleanest possible opinion for the defense. His opinion, he testified, is that Lindsay Clancy was, due to her mental disease, unable to conform her conduct to the requirements of the law on the day she took the lives of her children. The basis? The command voice. She was hearing a voice commanding the killing, he said, and she felt no sense of control. She felt she had to obey. He also gave the defense something subtler, a credibility finding. She was, in his words, a more sophisticated patient than most, and forthcoming, with one exception he identified precisely, her fear that disclosure would cost her the children.
A measured opinion. Not a blanket endorsement, but a structured one. For the Commonwealth, Dr. Kirk Heilbrun conceded the diseased limb outright. My opinion was, that and is, that she suffered from a major depressive episode, part of a major depressive disorder, within months of the birth, and then attacked the control arm evidence methodically. His instrument was the research literature on malingering, the fabrication or exaggeration of symptoms for an external purpose, and specifically on malingered hallucination claims, how fabricated voice reports differ from genuine ones. And watching him apply it is a lesson in how forensic psychology tries to make the unmeasurable measurable. Genuine command hallucinations, he testified, are in about 88% of cases accompanied by a related delusion. Miss Clancy reported none.
Genuine hallucinations are typically intermittent. They come and go. Hers, by her account, came once, stayed constant for 18 to 20 minutes, and never returned. People experiencing such voices usually attempt to cope, to pray, to play music, to resist. She reported no attempt at all. Points in the other direction, the voice was experienced as external, which fits the genuine pattern. His own scorecard, given in his own words, about 3 points on which her account more closely resembled exaggerated or fabricated hallucinations, one where it looked more genuine, and one that was mixed. 3 to 1 to 1. And on that arithmetic, the Commonwealth built its control arm case. It is worth pausing on what that arithmetic is, a structured expert judgment, not a measurement.
The framework has no way to assign a probability to a single case, and Heilbrun's own testimony conceded a genuine point on the other side of the scale.
And then the third expert, the Commonwealth's Dr. Gregory Sothoff, produced the opinion that the whole article turns on because it revealed the structure of the prosecution's victory condition more clearly than anything else in the trial. Yes, he testified. In his opinion, Lindsay Clancy did have a mental disease or defect on January 24th, bipolar 2 disorder, depressive symptoms, exacerbated by sleep problems and adverse medication reactions. And then, in the same sequence of testimony, my clinical opinion is that she was criminally responsible on January 24th. Read those two sentences together, slowly. The Commonwealth's own psychiatric expert accepted the first limb of the McCool test, the disease, and the prosecution's case therefore depended entirely on the capacity limbs, on proving that inside that diagnosed, medicated, hospitalized weeks earlier illness, she retained both a meaningful understanding of wrongfulness and the ability to obey. His route there was the phone call and the window, the speed, the method, the mid-act conversation, evidence, he said, of execution consistent with choice. His alternative reconstruction was the most striking sentence any expert offered in the trial. A serious suicide attempt, accompanied by killing the children out of love.
Step back from the three experts and look at what the jury actually had. Two distinguished forensic evaluators agreed she had a qualifying mental disease. They disagreed about what it permitted, and the disagreement was not resolved by any test, scan, or instrument, because none exists. It was resolved, in the end, by each expert's theory of the same behavior. The prosecution read the window and the phone call as proof of steering. The defense read them as the last organized acts of a collapsing mind that had announced its illness to everyone around it for months. The jury was not choosing between a measurement and a guess. It was choosing between two guesses, each wearing the authority of medicine.
There is one more episode from the trial that belongs in this article, because it shows what happens when the machinery of expert evidence crosses a line the law has drawn. During Heilbrunn's direct examination, while describing the defendant's statements about the afterlife, the witness testified that she said, and this is his testimony, "Go to God, baby. Go to God." And then went further into the defendant's upbringing. She was raised as a Catholic, he said. And as I understand, Catholic considerations, that is not necessarily what happens. The courtroom detonated, quietly and procedurally. Reddington moved for a mistrial, calling it intentional misconduct, injecting Roman Catholic faith and the concept of mortal sin into a murder trial, and noting it was the second time the case had brushed that line. The prosecutor answered that the question had not sought religion and offered to rein in the witness. Judge Sullivan's ruling was a study in damage control. He refused the mistrial and instead told the jury, in the plainest language a judge can use, that the religion the defendant was raised with is absolutely an inappropriate area of testimony. It is to be stricken. It is not to be considered. I cannot be any more clear than that.
A curative instruction. The law's standard remedy when a jury hears something it should not. The judge's directive to disregard it. And the whole episode raises the question that follows such remedies everywhere. Whether a jury can actually unhear a thing once it has been said, or whether the curative instruction is the legal system's polite fiction, a rule that exists so the trial can continue, rather than because anyone believes memory works that way.
The strongest case against this article's skepticism deserves to be stated at full strength, because it is the case for the McCool test itself, and it is not weak. The law cannot do otherwise. If criminal responsibility were decided by diagnosis, verdicts would be outsourced to whichever psychiatrist a side could hire, and the trial would be a battle of credentials rather than evidence. If mental state were ignored entirely, the law would punish people who could not have chosen otherwise, which is the definition of injustice. So the law does the only thing available. It gives a jury of ordinary citizens a legal standard, capacity, appreciation, control, and lets them weigh everything, including the very behavior the prosecution relied on, the window, the phone call, the method.
Behavioral evidence of capacity is at least falsifiable in a way symptom reports are not. And the two-path burden, properly understood, is generous to defendants. The government must prove sanity, not the defendant prove illness. The messiness this article describes may simply be the visible cost of asking a just question in an unjust world of limited knowledge.
What would change the calculus? Three findings would disprove or confirm this article's skepticism, stated concretely. First, if the retrial, now scheduled, the case was set for a September 29th status and trial assignment hearing, with a defense motion for a required finding of not guilty to be heard, produces a clean verdict under the same instruction without procedural incident, the instrument demonstrably worked as designed, and this article's structural critique shrinks to one trial's difficulty, rather than the test's. Second, if forensic psychology produces a validated functional capacity instrument, something that actually measures rather than frames what a defendant could appreciate or control, the methodology critique here dates quickly.
Third, if the Massachusetts appeals courts, in this case or another, clarify or tighten the capacity standard in response to trials like this one, then the law itself will have conceded that the question as currently asked is not answerable, and the doctrine will move.
It is worth saying what this article has not claimed. It has not claimed Lindsay Clancy was responsible, or that she was not. The first trial produced no verdict, and this article takes no position on the one the retrial may reach. It has not claimed any diagnosis. Every diagnosis mentioned here is attributed to the witness who testified to it, and nothing here is an independent medical judgment. It has not claimed the medication caused anything. The chronology is the defense's documentary record, and the limits of what it proves are the subject of the trial itself. It has not claimed the experts were hired guns or honest professionals. It is claimed only that their methods cannot deliver the certainty the verdict form demands.
And it has not claimed the jury got anything wrong, because the jury never got to decide, which is the subject of the second article.
What the first trial established, before it collapsed, is the shape of the modern insanity defense in a courtroom that takes it seriously. Not a verdict on madness, but a verdict on the residue. What remains of choice and understanding after the disease has been conceded by everyone, including the prosecution's own experts? The judge told the jury that knowledge is not appreciation, that diagnosis is not the legal test, and that the Commonwealth must prove at least one path to responsibility beyond a reasonable doubt. Then he sent them to deliberate. What happened inside that deliberation? The note that arrived on the third day, the juror who would not bend, and the constitutional dead end that followed is the story of the second article, the 11th juror.
At myaudiobooks.ai, you can create fiction, nonfiction, and turn your documents into audio, all stored in one place with a single subscription. Plus, get instant access to thousands of audiobooks and deep dive investigations. Learn more today at myaudiobooks.ai. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.